Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Ben Zdenchanovich. I'm your host today. I will be interviewing Ben Holtzman, an assistant professor of history at Lehman College. And Ben studies the intersection of political and social history in the United States, with a particular focus on politics, capitalism, race and class, cities, and social movements. His research has been supported by fellowships from the Mellon Foundation, the Miller Center at the University of Virginia, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He has published academic articles in Modern American History, the Journal of Social History, the Journal of Urban History, and several edited collections. And today we'll be discussing his really fantastic first book, The Long Crisis, New York City and the Path to Neoliberalism, published by Oxford University Press in 2021. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm very grateful for the invitation.
Great, absolutely. So why don't we start by, if you'll just sort of introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your scholarly background, your interests, and what led you to this particular project.
Yeah, so you did really appreciate that kind and thorough introduction, and that covered some of the basics there. So as you mentioned, I have been teaching at Lehman College as part of the City University of New York system since the fall of 2020, and I'm really happy and grateful to be a part of that rich, vibrant tradition of public education. And I teach courses there on a variety of subjects, American politics, social and political history, New York history, social movements, and the like. So I initially, got involved or got interested in this project. So like many academic first books, this began as a dissertation. So I went to, did my PhD at Brown University. And, I had also grown up in the suburbs of New York City. And when I was thinking about a dissertation topic, I was thinking about, a number of different possibilities and the kind of scholarly questions. And one of the things that kind of stood out to me was, especially I'm a historian, my PhD is in history, I work as a professional historian, and historians have spent, a lot of time at that point really thinking about, for the post-war period, the period of the, urban crisis, and really thinking about the decline of cities in the post-war decades, and kind of the variety of reasons for that, and the variety of ramifications of that, particularly in the industrial Midwest and in the Northeast, along with the rise of the Sun Belt. But historians had thought a little bit less at that time about the kind of period after the urban crisis, the period of what for many cities in the late 20th century was a period of economic rejuvenation or gentrification. And so I was really interested in kind of thinking about that period. Simultaneously, it was a period that I was somewhat old enough to have experienced. So as I said, I grew up in the suburbs outside New York. So I have a sense of remembering just the very kind of visual elements, the impressions that one would have as a child of you know, having somebody who was, even as a young person, spending a fair amount of time in New York City, seeing the changes from early memories in the 1980s through some of the transformations that were taking place under Mayor Rudy Giuliani in the 1990s. And really wanted to think about that, how that transformation really took place. So there's both a scholarly need and a personal interest in really exploring those questions and doing so in New York. And the last thing I'll say about that is that when I really kind of began moving into some of the literature around the economic and political transformation of urban areas in the late 20th century, as I said, there was less at that time from coming from historians, more coming from sociologists and geographers. You know, that literature really gave us a really rich understanding of some of the political and economic transformations that were happening in the city at this time, thinking through processes of inequality, of gentrification, of displacement. But I found that a lot of those, that literature, often with a kind of Marxist influence, it tended to, without trying to oversimplify the process, oversimplifying what they're describing, really depict this as a process of that was overwhelmingly really led by kind of market-oriented individuals, more kind of conservative-minded folks, what we think of as the kind of classic neoliberals. And, you know, I thought that that was, you know, really interesting to me and a really worthwhile way of explaining it. But I wondered if there was more to the story. And so really thinking about the question of how New York in particular, and this was a stand-in, of course, for what's happening for many cities across the United States in the late 20th century, how the economic and political changes were taking place in the city, and how maybe they were being shaped by a wide variety of city populations that went beyond the kind of more elites or business interests or, market-oriented neoliberal mayors that we had tended to associate with that process. And so exploring that and thinking about that question really led me towards beginning the project.
Great. So, why don't you just kind of lay out the argument of the book? What are some of the broader claims that you're making here? And then maybe we can dive a little bit closer into some of the specific case studies that you look at here.
Yeah. No. Great. So there's a couple different arguments that I'm making in the book. And so one of them is, you know, kind of what I ended on, to really think about this process of, you know, if we want to think about it as neoliberalism, you know, a process that tends to be associated with increase of kind of political and economic processes that rely more and more on the market and private sector, all right? So that kind of shift from the provision of more government or state-oriented services and processes towards empowering and a greater, both an empowering of and a greater reliance on the private sector and market for the provisions of various kinds of services, or, you know, eliminating them entirely. And so to think about that process as one that of how it rolled out locally on the ground and by a wider swath of actors than the literature had previously really tended to depict that process as taking place. So what I found as I dove into a variety of case studies that were looking at the transformation of New York during this period was that it was often New Yorkers who were really concerned about the conditions of their neighborhoods or their local park or the city entirely, who were beginning to enact various kinds of processes or solutions or experiments to deal with those conditions, that began a process and facilitated a larger process that then pushed the city towards the greater reliance on the private sector market. So that's to say that let me back up a little bit from that explanation. So, you know, kind of the project really begins in the late 1960s when the city, when New York is really beginning to experience a real economic decline. It's the beginning of a long period of economic and municipal budget cutbacks in the city. Services begin to constrain. So that's really the starting point for the project. And what I'm doing in the project is really seeing how New Yorkers responded to those conditions on the ground, in their neighborhoods, in different communities. And again, what I really tended to find in a variety of case studies was them turning towards a variety of experiments to kind of try to hold on to existing municipal services or preserve, you know, services like the conditions they expected in parks or a kind of right to a certain security in housing or responding to new issues like rising crime. And that in doing so, they led to they really helped to facilitate a larger process that ended up pushing the city towards a greater reliance on the private sector and market for the provision of those kinds of services. So that's one of the arguments of the book, and I can get into other arguments or get into some of the case studies.
Yeah, why don't we talk a little bit more about this process of decline itself? So maybe we can start with chronologically what is what's preceding this in the sort of New Deal during the New Deal order from the 1930s through the 1950s, early 1960s. We have people like Joshua Freeman have really identified as kind of a sort of a social democratic sort of oasis in New York City, right? With an enormous amount of public services, federal and municipal investment. What if you could just talk a little bit more about that and, you know, how, what exactly is driving this process of decline over the 1960s and 1970s?
Right. Yeah. No. That's an important place to really add some necessary context to the period that I'm looking at. So I appreciate you raising that. So really, beginning in the 1930s and really through the 1960s, especially, there's a significant investment on behalf of the federal government in cities. That really tends to be true in a place like New York. It's not exclusively a story limited to New York, but we really see a kind of mutual relationship between a certain level of federal investment in cities and along with a series of local administrators in New York who are trying to really, by and large, boost a kind of provision of municipal services. So New York is home to, you know, a range of things like public hospitals, a vibrant city university system that had for many, many years provided free education, very low transit fees, in addition to just an enormous transit system to make, access to public transportation and mobility available to working class populations, a vibrant park system. And so, you know, it'd be easy to, I think, overstate the widespread, this was not a utopia by any means, and it was a structure that was always embedded with a certain amount of class and especially racial inequalities throughout. So it is not a period in which inequality is being eliminated, and that we especially see less of an investment in addressing various kinds of racial inequities differences in access to municipal services by across race. But at the same time, that there is a particular investment and one that does tend to, cut across wide populations of the city in creating a kind of robust, socially democratic oriented city. And that really begins to, really begins to come apart in the 1960s. And it happens, you know, for a variety of reasons. It's cast overwhelmingly, particularly in the 1970s, when the city is at the worst of its economic crisis, and nearly goes bankrupt in the 1970s, as being simply about an excess of provision of social services, and particularly things like welfare. Now, in truth, this is vastly overstated, and is, you know, essentially a kind of especially racialized boogeyman that's used to really strip away many of these, this or undo this system in the midst of New York's bankruptcy in the mid-1970s. That's not to say that the New York's municipal government had always been, particularly into the 1970s, run in a fiscally responsible manner. New York, especially in the late 60s and into the early 1970s, is incurring tremendous amounts of debt. But the story to its economic decline is a bit more complex, you know, involving a lessening of investment of cities by on behalf of the federal government, a disproportionate burden of various kinds of healthcare costs that are that New York faces that are unlike other kinds of cities across the country, and of course, familiar kinds of stories for what's happening in other cities, like an exodus of white sort of middle class populations to the suburbs, a disproportionate investment on behalf of the federal government in suburban areas, capital flight, those kinds of things that are really stripping away at the economic foundation of that more socially democratic oriented system that leads to a period of really economic decline and economic restrictions in the late 60s and certainly into the 1970s.
Right. So what is this period of this process of decline, of disinvestment? What are the consequences for, everyday life in New York City? What is this starting to look like over the course of this of the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, so this is felt in all sorts of different ways, and especially work conditions had long been troubled in lower income communities of color. Conditions decline further in terms of the conditions of schools, in terms of the conditions of parks, and the city gets dirtier. But that's also something, and that is simultaneously an experience or a condition that, while at its worst, is in the kinds of areas that had long suffered those kinds of conditions, that really extends to larger swaths of the city, right? So, and I think really surprising ways. I mean, again, we can kind of stick with the example of parks. It might surprise New Yorkers who are familiar with, present day New York City to know that Bryant Park in the heart of the Midtown Manhattan was really by the 1970s considered a really dangerous park to too many people. We could get into whether the extent to which that's overstated. Same thing with Central Park, but nonetheless, the perception of the park as a kind of dirty, crime-ridden place in the heart of a kind of business district of Manhattan, nonetheless speaks to a kind of decline of conditions in the city that are experienced during this time. And even, I think, less noted in terms of what gets media attention, but in the outer boroughs of Staten Island or Queens or Brooklyn, a similar kind of concern with lessened funding for schools, worsening conditions in parks, increases in crime, those kinds of things that really alarm a lot of New Yorkers about the conditions that they are then facing. in this period.
Right. So, speak a little bit more about this, this sort of, bottom up sort of grassroots, response to this disinvestment, this sort of, you know, decline that is taking place in New York City.
Yeah. So again, what I found and what I trace in a number of, in across my case studies in a number of different sectors of life, across New York, is that New Yorkers really become not just simply alarmed by these conditions, but determined to improve them, to change them. So for instance, in the early 1970s, New Yorkers flood in volunteer projects into parks, you know, armed with litter bags and, planting gear and things and the like to try to improve conditions, in those parks, right? They start to, in response to rising crime, begin to form community patrols. And this is something that happens not just in white middle income areas, but in lower income areas of color. Same is true for what happens with parks. We see these kinds of moves being made in a variety of different kinds of neighborhoods across race and class. And as part of this process, so I should say too, that as part of this process, you know, there's a real determination to kind of, in the midst of thinking that, look, it seems like the government or the city government just can't provide the kinds of resources that it can to really aim to do something about it. So to improve housing, to address crime, to improve conditions in parks and the like. And what I simultaneously was really surprised to see is that this was by and large done less out of a kind of denouncement or explicit frustration with the kind of liberal politics, right? Than simply a desire to improve circumstances. So this goes back a little bit to one of the other kind of interventions or arguments of the book, is that what's in part driving this process this shift and this towards more market oriented private sector kinds of solutions that are begin to be spurred by a lot of these community level initiatives is less a desire to denounce liberalism and bring in a new system than really to improve circumstances, right? So a lot of the literature that had that really thinks about this process tends to depict it as one that is carried out by people who are really against this kind of more socially democratic processes, or even local liberal officials who had long supported those kind of more robust municipal services. In contrast, I really found that it was actually the expectations that had been risen through prior decades of robust municipal services that then leads in the face of those conditions seemingly to be diminished, leads a variety of actors in New York to undertake new experiments to try to maintain them. So again, they're not really less driven, or they're driven less by a kind of ideological, denunciation of liberal politics than they are with trying to experiment with maintaining those conditions. At first, they hope that that's going to be a short-term process, right? But over time, as it seems that municipal services actually, remain, or municipal budgets and services remain troubled into the 1970s, and as these experiments with new kinds of ways of providing kinds of services that rely less on government prove to bear some fruits, that they begin to think of these as potentially more long-term solutions, right? But that's not the idea at the beginning.
So yeah, I think that's one of the more fascinating claims and discoveries that you make, is these are not free market ideologues who are driving this process, right? We have these sort of top down intellectual political histories from people like Kim Phillips Fine and others about you know, neoliberalization as a sort of political ideological project. You're really looking at reliance on the private sector, marketization as sort of an experimental way of improvising, of filling this sort of vacuum that disinvestment is creating.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really nice way of putting it, and that is the process that I'm charting in the book, and that I really found through a variety of these kinds of case studies. The thing that I would add is that the argument isn't that neoliberalism was simply an entirely grassroots process. So, I think that what I'm trying to show, or among the things that I'm trying to show, is that part of that history, right? And that part of that history that I think had by and large really hasn't been part of the literature and discussions of the process of neoliberalism. So in each of the chapters, I'm really ultimately showing how these kinds of this kind of bottom up, or even what we might think of as kind of mid-level efforts, or really a variety of processes that are might be originated by grassroots organizations or nonprofits or cultural institutions or foundations, a variety of kind of sectors that we tend, especially during the late 60s and into the 70s, not to think of when we think about neoliberalism, as playing a key role in the process. Now, at the same time, I do show the ways in which those who are driven by a more ideological, there are certainly actors in New York, in the real estate sector, as one example, and there are others who are very committed to a vision of transforming New York that will lessen government kinds of provisions and increase the role of the private sector and market in governing New York. So I'm showing where the kind of grassroots meets those more kind of elite-driven processes. So it's not to say that those actors don't play a role. They play an important role, and they're there throughout my entire book. The more market ideological, actors that we tend to associate with this process. I'm arguing that just focusing on those actors, or maybe put another way, by showing how this process unfolds on the ground in communities across a local city, we can see a much broader swath of actors, of communities who are part of driving this process, right? And how their actors really, or how their actions help to create a kind of crevices and opportunities, or just are happening alongside more top-down led processes. And that's the way that neoliberalism both unfolds and sweeps into so many different aspects of life in a city like New York and many others during this time, right? But we have to understand how both those processes are happening in order to see how neoliberalism takes such a powerful hold in the late 20th century.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think one of the strengths of the book is you have a lot of very detailed and sort of wide-ranging case studies looking at various sectors of the economy in the city, various aspects of New York daily life that is being transformed through this process. So why don't you just take us through some of the specific examples that you explore here that show us how this process is actually taking place on the ground?
Sure. Well, I'll start with something that I've mentioned a few times, and I'm happy to talk about other case studies as well, but I've mentioned parks a few times, so I'll just kind of continue that thread. So the end point of the park story is that people might not know, but in New York today, the vast majority of large parks in New York, especially in Manhattan and in business districts, are now run by what are essentially private organizations who are responsible for fundraising and, in many cases, the management of parks. So, Central Park, Bryant Park, Madison Park, that they're, pick a park in Manhattan in particular, and you can see that these are actually in many cases really managed by these private organizations. So how did that process come to be? Well, I show that, as I mentioned earlier, the ways in which as park conditions really began to decline at a local level. So I in the outer boroughs, in places like Kew Gardens in Queens, in other parts of Brooklyn and the Bronx, as conditions decline, that people begin to rush into their parks to begin to try to improve conditions in them, right? And they begin to do so and really do so with a kind of ideology that they begin to express that government, that it seems that the city government really can no longer maintain these kinds of conditions in parks. And that process is well underway in the late 1960s into the 1970s. As I mentioned, not done with an antipathy towards liberal politics in the city, but done out of a real desire to improve local conditions in parks, right? And they're fostering all sorts of innovative ways to improve conditions, from fundraising to volunteerism to really even asking the city to increase the amount of outside control that they can have over local parks in the face of declining municipal services. Now, I trace that story and how that idea really gets picked up by some of the more notable parks in New York. So I really move that into especially a story about what happens in Central Park, right? And so Central Park is going through a period of decline in the 1970s, that there are kind of, the grass is decayed, the infrastructure isn't being kept up. There's various kinds of labor issues in upkeep of the park, growing concerns about crime, and really just a small number of park advocates begin to form small organizations that begin to promote a similar kind of idea. The city can't maintain conditions in parks. Not, again, with an ultimate desire to strip away control of parks from the city or Central Park from the city, but as a means to try to preserve conditions within a beloved park. And they, similarly promote various kinds of volunteerism, various kinds of fundraising initiatives, and that, and to really come up with a new solution. And I show how that, idea takes a growing hold in New York, right? And that it really is only when, or especially when, there's a risk of the city actually losing control of the park. So there's a proposal in the late 1970s to potentially, even shift a Central Park to control by, a different branch of government, because it just seems like the city cannot maintain conditions in Central Park, right? That this becomes such an alarming idea that then that you know, really helps to facilitate new proposals. And the proposal especially becomes this formation of this organization called the Central Park Conservancy, which is going to be comprised of more, both park advocates and more kind of elite figures who can do the kinds of fundraising that they think that the park is going to need from the private sector, that then, you know, pushes for that kind of new solution for parks management, right? So tracing that process over a number of years, begins to show us a slightly, more complex or different understanding of how the park system over the late 20th century really moves from being seen as almost the kind of quintessential municipal service, right? Like what could be more fundamental to one of the a role that city government should play than providing green space in the city, to one that over time we have large swaths of the park system being controlled by what are essentially private organizations. I'll add there too, just at the end, that then Central Park becomes a model not just for other parks in New York, but parks across the country. The Central Park Conservancy in particular is really held up as a kind of model for this kind of, public-private organization that can begin to fundraise for and even manage parks across the entire country.
And you also show, especially with parks like Bryant Park, I believe it was, that, it's not only these private sort of nonprofit organizations who are sort of taking over the role of managing parks. They're also enlisting the corporate sector, real estate interests as well, and convincing business that it is in their financial interest to take a role in the maintenance of parks.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So again, this process unfolds, it kind of develops over time, and it goes from a kind of more grassroots-led process with these community-led efforts to a process that in Central Park is both kind of combining ideas about traditional volunteerism with of everyday New Yorkers while looking to more elite figures to serve as kind of fiscal guardians of the park, towards quickly expanding towards an even more extensive model with the case of Bryant Park. And this unfolds in the late 1970s and into the early 1980s. One disadvantage that Bryant Park has is that it doesn't really have a constituency. So it's not a local park that is surrounded by a residential area, which is, true not just for neighborhood parks, but for even a central park, which has a constituency of people who live around it, along with many New Yorkers who just truly love that park. In contrast, Bryant Park is in Midtown Manhattan in a business district, right? So, and there are some efforts in the late 1970s to try to, for people who are concerned about Bryant Park to do something about declining conditions. There's a park commissioner who in the early 1970s goes so far as to say that Bryant Park should perhaps just be simply shut down in the face of the inability to maintain existing conditions within it. But as you sort of said, there are other proposals that develop over time. And in particular, there's one that gets really championed by the institution that shares this space in many ways with Bryant Park, which is the main branch of the New York Public Library. So the New York Public Library finds that in the late 1970s, as it begins to try to undertake a major fundraising campaign for itself, that its traditional funders, the foundations to which it would normally go to support its capital campaign, say, we're not going to give you money to continue to, exist or to promote your endeavors for the public library system, if people won't come to the library because they're so concerned about what's happening in Bryant Park, right? And particularly in terms of concerns about crime, right? So Bryant Park, the New York Public Library officials really are part of a process that begins to turn to the corporations whose headquarters surround the park. And they too begin to turn to their they're, you know, like-minded corporate officials, right, who are also as part of the park, and they fail. There's a number of unsuccessful efforts who, as, you know, corporate leaders try to turn to, you know, others in the private sector to say, you know, we need your financial support to improve conditions in Bryant Park. This is going to be, you know, not just good for the city, but good for us. Who, and those corporate leaders say, what are you, crazy? Why would we give money to support a public park? That idea is just bonkers. You know, it takes years of legwork to actually convince the private sector that they're, you know, that their money and their initiatives are really needed, right? And so that process, through the work of the New York Public Library and some other key corporations that are surrounding the park, along with over time, you know, especially the ones that own their buildings, right? So again, there's simultaneously a kind of concern about real estate values, as you mentioned, right? To improve circumstances at Bryant Park, that leads to the creation of an organization called the Bryant Park Restoration Corporation, which in the early 1980s not only devotes itself to trying to improve conditions in the park, but ultimately begins even to convince city officials that they should really essentially take over the entire management of the park, right? And they succeed by the mid-1980s to really, not completely, but by and large, really run that park and put it more or less in private hands. It's just a remarkable transformation from the understandings of what, the role of the private sector versus government in providing that key municipal service, and who should play that role. That transformation just goes over, occurs rapidly over the course of the 1970s into the early 1980s.
And so a similar process is playing out with housing, as you show in one of your chapters. So you have some really striking statistics about, you know, how landlords, because their buildings are no longer profitable in this sort of period of white flight and disinvestment and deindustrialization, they're just really abandoning whole buildings and even whole city blocks. And you show how low-income New Yorkers, especially people of color, are sort of stepping into this situation. So could you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So this is a process that, a process that I traced in the first chapter of the book. And yeah, I think, the crisis of abandonment in New York that really begins to unfold in the late 60s is just another one of those unbelievably striking moments from today's perspective. The idea, as you said, that there are, not just individual units, but individual buildings, sometimes even blocks worth of buildings that are abandoned by landlords, and over time essentially become, rubble, is just so striking from, what is happening in New York in more recent decades, or what we know to be happening in, many other, really just about every other major U.S. City, right, where property values have just held so much value that the idea that you would walk away from the property that you own is staggering, right? But nonetheless, that process, for a variety of reasons, comes to take hold in New York. And what I show is first how, low-income, particularly people of color, particularly Puerto Rican and African-American residents who are facing the disproportionate burdens of abandonment in places like the Bronx or Central Brooklyn or the Lower East Side, after incurring this kind of torment of abandonment in their neighborhoods, begin to say, we need to do something about this process. So we're going to begin to actually take over these buildings, right? And not only are we going to take over these buildings, we're going to revitalize them ourselves, right? They call this process homesteading. And it really takes hold in a remarkable way, especially by the early 1970s in New York. Right. And it begins to be, you know, these groups of low income New Yorkers really begin to promote themselves as, you know, a key way to rejuvenate their areas, that they, as low income community members, residents of these areas, can lead that process of economic and rejuvenation, improve housing circumstances in some of the most dire neighborhoods of the city. Right. So it's really just an incredibly impressive process. But I show that how, as part of this process, they really begin to, you know, promote certain ideas, you know, that and how that process of homesteading simultaneously gets picked up by political officials as, you know, certain kind of more alluring aspects of homesteading gets picked up and held up as a model for economic rejuvenation by political supporters. So, you know, the idea that it's going to be private actors, not government, who leads rejuvenation of low-income areas. The idea that home ownership, right, not rent regulation, but that home ownership is going to be critical to this process, right? And that idea, you know, which homesteaders, I think, in part, weary of what had been a very troubled record of government investment in low-income communities of color by the early 1970s, in part to make politically appealing kind of messaging for the period, and in part reflecting their own kind of politics. These are, generally speaking, sometimes less kind of socialistic minded, activists coming with a slightly more distinct political philosophy. You really simultaneously, themselves promote similar kinds of ideas, right? So when I show how over the 1970s that as these homesteaders really get held up as a sign of what the private sector can do, right, and how what private actors, the role that private actors must play in economic rejuvenation of low income areas, and how by the early 1980s, especially as it is clear the amount of government investment that's going to be needed for homesteading to really be successful, that really undoes a lot of the momentum from homesteading, right, and that the what remains is still that kind of notion that it's the private sector that is going to lead the rejuvenation of these kinds of low-income areas of color. But what's simultaneously forgotten is some of the other appeals that homesteaders were making, right? That it was necessary to, have community members be empowered in these processes, that it was necessary for community members to control these processes, that it was important to maintain certain levels of affordability as parts of these processes, right? Those messages over time kind of fall by the wayside in favor of holding up, a selective messaging of that homesteaders were simultaneously promoting about the need for private actors to lead these processes of rejuvenation.
And what's the role of the city itself in this? Are city officials encouraging this process, or?
So they're a little bit, they're fairly skeptical in the late 60s and into the early 1970s and the early years of homesteading about the ability for homesteaders to really, play a key role in improving circumstances. Over time, city officials become more encouraging of these efforts, in part because there's so few other solutions. Things are so dire that it becomes, the 70s is such a period of experimentation in the midst of changing circumstances. I mean, it's a big theme of the book that just traditional understandings, or what had been longstanding understandings about, you know, the way the economy worked, about sort of the power of sort of New Deal liberal ideology, various kinds of, you know, economic and political dominant philosophies are really coming undone at the same time that longstanding, you know, powerhouses of the nation like New York are in severe decline. So it just ends up, for all sorts of reasons, being this period of incredible experimentation and transformation. It's why I think it's such a fascinating period, right? So it leads to a greater support for these kinds of homesteading efforts. I show there too that, you know, again, by the late 70s and into the 1980s, under the tenure of Mayor Ed Koch, who comes into office, unlike prior mayors in New York, with a real firm commitment to enhancing the role of the private sector and market in city government, right? He's very clear about the need in his mind to do this, right? How he begins to encourage homesteading because there seems to be no better solution. But, you know, quickly finding ways to steer these processes, not simply to community members, but to, you know, in some cases, private developers, you know, these, or in other cases, to, you know, nonprofits that are less kind of connected to the community itself than, you know, oriented towards practices that make them less differentiated from, you know, more kind of for private developers. And he's able to do this in the 1980s because so much of what had been simply abandoned buildings in the late 60s and into the 1970s come under municipal control. Especially in the late 70s. So, you know, these are buildings that, of course, landlords stop paying taxes on, you know, when they walk away from them. So increasingly, a number of these abandoned buildings are owned by the government, just, you know, tens of thousands of units of housing. So he's able to, you know, increasingly direct that housing, that municipally owned housing, away from community members themselves and towards these more kind of traditional private sector actors, to, you know, in his mind, kind of lead the economic rejuvenation of these low income and moderate income areas.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's such a fascinating project. And before we wrap up, I wondered if you could speak a little bit about what you might be working on now. Do you have a new book in the works?
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you. Yes, I'm working on a new project that's called Smash the Klan, Fighting the White Power Movement in the Late 20th Century. And this project is about how, in the late 1970s and into the 1980s, there is this major resurgence of white supremacist organizing across the country, particularly in the South. But the Ku Klux Klan, various other kinds of white nationalists and white supremacist sects come roaring back really across the country. And what I'm looking at in this book is the movement of activists that form to combat this growing threat. And this movement is comprised of sometimes veterans of the civil rights movement, you know, people who have been involved sometimes for, you know, going back to, you know, the 1950s or even the 1940s and various kinds of civil rights activism, who are coming together alongside younger activists who were more recently involved in kind of anti-racist organizing or coming out of the women's movement or the labor movement, who are coming together to form this movement. And I hope that this project can help us to understand a little bit more about both the trajectory of, you know, the kind of longer-lasting legacies of civil rights organizing after the 1960s, really kind of seeing a new thread that gets picked up by activists of who had been involved in or influenced by the 60s era of civil rights movement, alongside kind of thinking about the trajectory of the political left into the late 20th century. We tend to think of the political left as really being kind of battered during the Reagan era and even in the preceding decade. There's a lot of truth to that, but there's also a lot of examples of really powerful movements that form during this period. And I think that this movement is one of them. Unfortunately, too, of course, with the continued resurgence and momentum of white supremacists and white nationalists organizing today, I hope that there'll be some lessons that that we can look to from activists of the past to help to really continue to formulate strategies and support the continued organizing that is taking place today to combat these kinds of currents and undermine other aspects of white supremacy that exist throughout the country.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, that sounds like a fascinating and timely project. And so that's exciting that that's in the works. So we've taken up quite a bit of your time today. So let's end it here. Ben Holtzman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I am really grateful to all the listeners. So thank you.
Thank you.